Hello and welcome to Talking Scared. I'm your host, Neil McRobert, and this week I'm catching up with an honest-to-God contemporary classic. Our guest is Scott Hawkins, whose debut novel, The Library at Mount Char, exploded from nowhere back in 2015. Now it's being published for the first time in the UK by Titan Books. In the 7 years it took to cross the Atlantic, it's garnered the most loving fan base from those who've read it. And now Scott has joined me to give a rare glimpse at some of the insane machinery that propels his unique madcap story. You'll hear about the first scenes that started it all germinating in Scott's head, and you'll hear what Scott really thinks his novel is about. And of course, I have the temerity to give him my opinion. We talk about our unrestricted empathy for animals, despite Scott nearly being eaten by dogs. We find out the untold backstory of some of the more mysterious characters. We talk about cruelty and the ethics of demigods. And we keep it real with the horrors of kidney stones. Fans of the book, you'll love this. Those yet to read it, you'll definitely want to. Before we start, remember, you can support Talking Scared by signing up to Patreon. The link is in the show notes, or just go to patreon.com/talkingscaredpod for loads of bonus content, including extra stuff from Scott. But otherwise, here we go, to a typical house on a typical street where infinite stories await, as do monsters. Let's talk scared. Well, hello, Scott, and welcome to Talking Scared.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for having me.
How are you today, and where in the world do we find you?
I'm doing very well. I am in a suburb of Atlanta, Georgia, called Canton. It's kind of, if you go out of Atlanta and drive north until you see cows, is how I would characterize the area. So that's, there's literally woods outside the window and all that. So it's kind of a rural area.
Oh, nice. Are you an Atlanta native, a Georgia? Georgia born?
No, well, I've been here 30 years, but I grew up in South Carolina and was born in Idaho, which is on the opposite side of the country.
Yeah.
So my dad was in the nuclear industry, and there's basically, you can either, there's like only two or three nuclear centric plants in the country, and we bounced around back and forth between all of them when I was a kid.
Okay. So you swapped kind of potatoes for cows by the sound of things.
Yes. Yeah, that's pretty accurate.
Okay. Right. Well, that is a very prosaic start to what is sure to be a very, well, what's the opposite of prosaic, but whatever it is, that kind of episode. It's an unusual case this today, as befitting the book in question, because normally I invite guests on this show to talk about new releases. On occasion, I've invited people on regardless, either because of their general status in the genre, because their books are classic, or just because I want to speak to them. You're the first person I've invited on this show because so many people have clamored for me to get you on.
That's fun to hear.
Yeah, yeah. Specifically to talk about The Library at Mount Char, which is the book in question. It's your first novel, and it was published 2015, so 7 years ago in the US, but it's only just been published for the first time here in the UK by Titan Books. So it will be new to some and very familiar to others. And as we've discussed off air, we may get a little bit more spoilery than I normally do on this podcast. So new readers, you have been warned. We're going to get into it. That said, this is not a book that I even want to try to summarize. But for those who haven't read it yet, can you introduce us to The Library at Mount Char?
Oh gosh, it's tough to encapsulate without giving too much away. Like you say, there's I would characterize it as a dark fantasy set in a magic library. When the book opens, a very powerful figure that the children, well, adult children who live in this library, referred to as father, is missing and possibly dead. This is of particular concern because they all kind of secretly suspect that the guy they call father may in fact be God. So they're naturally concerned to find out what might have become of him, and it kind of goes from there.
That's a quite benign summary of what is in part a very cruel novel. But we'll get to all that. We'll get to all that. I am right. Where do you even start with a book like this? I mean, you know, actually, that will do. That will do. The question of where do you start? Because where did you start? There are so many kind of insane left field ideas in this novel. So many of them. Was there actually a ground zero? Was there a very first seed that everything grew from?
There were probably, I would say, three core scenes. One of them was who ended up being the lead character, Carolyn, meeting Steve in a bar. Steve's the kind of male lead who you kind of see the world unfold through his eyes. He's new to all this. And they met in a bar, and Carolyn asked Steve if he wanted to break into a house. They'd never met before, total strangers. I just thought that was kind of an interesting premise. I mean, where, you know, why would they want to break into a house? And they, you know, it wasn't, what were Carolyn's motives for this and why Steve in particular and that kind of thing. So I was chewing on that. And I don't really write sequentially. I tend to just, like, you know, whatever, when I'm starting a new project, I'll just whatever sounds good that day, sounds intriguing, I'll kind of explore that without any real kind of master plan as to where it's all going to go. So I had that scene and I tinkered with that for a while. And there was a second one that became kind of a linchpin was this actually happened to me. There was a guy jogging through a neighborhood and he gets chased by a pack of feral dogs. And if you've read the book, you probably know which scene I'm talking about. That actually happened to me. I was teaching in a small town, about 100 miles from here called Rome, Georgia. And there was a neighborhood, that bordered some woods. And I guess people just, it was the kind of place where, like, rural people would dump their dogs. So there was like this pack of wild dogs in the woods. And I was out jogging one day and I had they were coming after me. I mean, this was, I don't know, probably 8 or 10 good sized dogs, German shepherds and pit bulls and that kind of thing. And it was just terrifying. I mean, unless you've been, I'd always thought of dog. I was actually with my own personal dog, a Labrador. And all my experience of dogs to that point had been very friendly and positive. And these guys, I was pretty sure were going to eat me. And I was thinking I'm going to get, like, ripped to pieces inside of these suburban houses. and so that kind of stuck with me. And I was like, well, maybe I should write about that one. So I tacked that one in there. And then the third one was at the very end of the book, there's a family, there's like neighborhood picnic, that went spectacularly wrong. And that was the third key piece. And then I just, you know, started stitching them together and, you know, we need a bad guy and, you know, that kind of thing.
So you make it sound so simple, but this is a book that just brings all of these insanely kind of madcap details together. And rather than it being one of those things where it's just a sequence of nonsense, because I hate that. I hate these books or any story really that is absurd for its own sake, right? I really don't like it. And often, I know that you're a pantser rather than a planner, as you just said. And often, when someone is working in such a far-out idea and they're not a planner, it ends up being that thing where it's just absurdity upon absurdity. And it becomes almost like Thomas Pynchon, you know, which I just don't get on with, that kind of thing. Whereas this ends up tied in a neat little bow. Is that just a feat of, like, endless editing? Or did you just slowly find your way to that ending first time round?
No. It was. I worked on this book for probably 5 years off and on. No kidding. That first chapter I was talking about, where the guy and the girl met in the bar, I had probably 80,000 words of different versions of that. And that's a novel length manuscript in itself. And I think the chapter as published ended up being 7,000 or 8,000 words. So I throw a lot out. And there were any number of sequences and kind of subplots that just weren't working, and I chunked them. And by the time I got through all the stuff that wasn't working, and I had the things I was fond of, they kind of started to stitch together in my head. I'm a very big fan of, like, the film noir, femme fatale kind of, stories. And once I had that kind of as an underlying background, I think I pretty much rewrote the whole thing from scratch using a lot of the same scenes and, you know, the same wording and stuff. But I did that in the course of maybe 3 or 4 months. And that was close to the version that was finally published.
Right. I mean, I know it's your debut novel, but in the afterword, you mention other unpublished manuscripts. So What was the journey for you? How many novels did you attempt before Mount Char?
Well, I would say I have three completed ones and one probably abandoned halfway through. The third one was I thought it was actually pretty close to getting published, but the problem was it was an animal story told entirely in the point of view of, you know, animals. It was like the last wolf of the North Woods.
Okay.
You know, because
Shardik type of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And although I was pretty happy with it overall, and I think it was, if the subject matter had been a little different, I think it would have had a shot. But it's just animal stories are a tough sell to the adult market, and this was very much an adult market book.
Okay. Did this one feel differently? Did Mount Char, in the writing, did it feel different or more successful?
It really did. When I was writing it, I was like, yeah, I think I'm onto something here. And I honestly, the point I knew, my wife is my, kind of my first reader, and she's blunt. If she doesn't like it, she will tell you. And she, so like the day I handed it over to her for, you know, kind of a first read, she came out of the hall. I remember her coming out of the back room and, she's like, it's actually really good. I mean, she, you know, surprised look on her face. And I was like, hey, I think we're getting somewhere.
I've seen you credit your wife a lot in other places. You always, I saw you say that you wish that was the part of the writing process people ask more about, that your wife's involvement in things.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to do the writing pretty much solo. I don't like to, because again, I go back and forth on so many things, and, you know, do different versions of stuff that until I've got something, you know, more or less coherent, I don't show it around. But once I do, it's fair game, and, you know, she'll tell me what she likes and what she doesn't. Actually, there was originally a different ending to Mount Char that she just straight up hated, and we got rid of that entirely.
Okay. I'm intrigued now.
I'll tell you what. I'm not sure if I can tell you without.
Let's talk about the book we have, not the book that could have been, because that's an endless conversation.
Yep.
Well, actually, before we get into the story itself, I am interested. People genuinely seem to adore this book in quite a special way. You know, there are these certain books that when you read people's opinions of, they glow in a way that other books don't. I mean, Emily Hughes, I've got to give props to Emily Hughes, who is the site editor over at Tor Nightfire. Mount Char is her favorite book, and she's the reason I read it. She's been
really Emily. I know Emily.
But there you go. She adores your book.
Wow!
And she's on at me all the time to read it. So I did, and thank you, Emily. And when I posted this that you were coming on the show, I kept seeing the same thing. People kept saying they envy me the experience of reading it for the first time.
Wow.
And that's the way I feel about my favorite books, Lord of the Rings, Stephen King's It, you know, Lonesome Dove. Like, my favorite, I wish I could sometimes have a very kind of localized memory loss so I could read it again for the first time. And I just wonder, over the years, it's been 7 years now, have you had your own feedback? What do you think speaks to people so profoundly about this book? Do you have any insight into that?
You know, that's a really good question. So, you were talking a minute ago about, you know, like books that you really wish you could, you know, read again for the first time. And for me, that book is probably more than anything is Stephen King's The Stand, which I read it when I was probably in eighth grade or something, and probably 100 times since then. And I've thought about it a lot, why it works and so forth. And I think, in addition to just, you know, kind of technique type things about, like, just, you know, kind of having a little bit of tension on every page, you know, where I would go, when I did the edit, or one of the final edits, I made a very conscious decision to go through the entire manuscript. And if I had like a page that was, you know, a little slow, I would either cut it or add a one liner or just, you know, kind of some gratuitously over the top, you know, kind of thing, just to keep the reader's attention, essentially. I want to make sure. So there was some very conscious, you know, kind of manipulation of at the page and paragraph level. Another thing I was trying to do consciously on kind of a more macro level was, I have this theory that the books that you respond to the most are books where the writer is talking about some phase of like personal growth that was important to them. And getting back to The Stand, I think, you know, Stephen King had recently lost his mother not too long before he was working on that book. And I really felt like a lot of the book was him coming to terms with this new sort of, you know, life as an orphan, because without a parent figure in his life. And this was kind of made visible through Larry Underwood, who went to New York to see his mom. You know, he needed his mom, and then she died. And
yeah, that's the first thing I thought. Yeah, because that's probably the most affecting scene in the entire novel.
I thought so. Yeah, I really thought so too. And you know, he's kind of coming to terms with that. So with me, like it was a conscious thing. Me, my dad died maybe 10 years or so before I was working on Mount Char. And he and I had kind of a little bit of a rocky relationship growing up. I mean, nothing terrible, but we butted heads a lot the way kids do. But by the time he ultimately passed away, we were actually very close, and I missed him terribly. But I remember there was one day not long before he died where I just kind of, it clicked with me that my dad was actually a really funny guy, and he'd been probably, you know, he'd been like this bone dry sense of humor my entire life, and I just never really got it until I was like 30 or so, and it was like I saw him in this whole new light, and that was something that I tried to incorporate into Mount Char, kind of revisit, you know, reevaluating your relationship with your parent in light of new information.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense now I've read the book. Because some of those revelations at the end are all about perspective, aren't they? They're all about, as you say, filling the blanks in memory and seeing things from a slightly different angle.
Yeah, nothing, you know, it was the same stuff happened. It's just you're kind of, oh, I get it now kind of thing.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you a question I've never asked an author before, because it's a ridiculously broad question.
Sure.
But I think in this case, because it's a book that is kind of has so much in it, I want to kind of cut through the Gordian knot, really, and perhaps unfairly ask you, what is this book really about? What's the theme? What's it getting at?
That you can adapt and overcome to any circumstances with adequate will. I think that's kind of what I would like to convey.
Okay. And I'm trying to work out now who's doing the overcoming, because to explain to readers who haven't read this, you've got a kind of number of protagonists is almost a difficult word because they're very complex characters. You don't even know who you're rooting for, but you've got like Carolyn, who is this young girl, one of the librarians, one of these almost demigods. And then you've got Steve, who is this very human figure. Who's doing the overcoming? Is it Carolyn or is it Steve or is it both?
A little of both, I think. Probably more Carolyn than Steve. The idea, oh God, and I'm going to have to go deep into spoiler territory here just to warn anybody who's listening who hasn't read the book.
That's fine. Listeners, flip forward a few minutes if you're worried.
Yeah. So everybody in the book, all the children in the book, all the demigod, you know, children, had, you know, difficulties with their with their upbringing. I mean, it was just nightmarish. It was, you know, in many ways the worst imaginable kind of thing. You couldn't even die to get out of it. Towards the end of the book, his father mentions to Carolyn that he had originally tried to make David be his heir. Father had the ability to like rewrite the past when it suited him, and he had tried 9 different times to make David, you know, fit into this mold. David just didn't have what it took. It was only Carolyn that was able to absorb the, you know, kind of lesson and overcome. They all had their problems. They'd all suffered equally, but she was the only one who like just had the absolute grit to go through with it. And to me, it's easy for me to say sitting in, you know, my comfortable suburb of Atlanta, but that is kind of the message I was trying to get across.
That works for me. Can I be arrogant enough to tell you what I think it's about?
Well, sure,
at least that's too arrogant, but let me say what it said to me, I suppose, is a better way of putting it.
Yeah, by all means.
These kids, each they're taken on to like learn in this library and study, and they each have their own specialism. So David, who is the antagonist of sorts, he has war, and then Margaret has death and the land of the forgotten, and then other characters have like the future or mathematics or healing, and there's more. But the gift that Carolyn is given is languages. And then that to me suggests that because she's our protagonist, that suggests to me that you consider that language is the most important subject or skill. But the novel is full of people who are failing to communicate. And then later on, Carolyn says about Steve, it's this really poignant moment. She says, "We use the same words, but they meant different things." And that's such an important sentence to me, because the way the modern world is, you know, we're all using the same words, but they mean different things to our different realities. And that felt to me like this nucleus of the story that I haven't really been able to fully articulate even to myself.
That makes a lot of sense. That was something that weighed heavily in my like kind of my academic career. I studied natural language processing in computer science. It's kind of colored my worldview ever since. So it's really interesting to hear you say that. That's like to you that was the core of it. And I honestly, I don't disagree. You're probably onto something there. That the words that are like you know the kind of arbitrary symbols that these words are. Mean only have meaning when they're attached to experience, and you know Carolyn's experience of the word adoption day is different from you know probably Steve's experience of the word adoption day, or you know words are like that. Or if you say the bull to David, you're going to get a much better or much different reaction than you would get if you said the bull to Steve or again. Yes, I mean, I think you're absolutely right that communication, that overcoming the gaps in their experience to in order to effectively communicate was a very strong underlying theme as well.
Yeah, it spoke to me as a really important, poignant thing about characters, but also a very analogous thing to our current divided culture that we live in, that no one seems able to bridge the gap, no matter what words we know and no matter what education we have, none of us seems able to bridge the gap.
Yeah, it's painful. It truly is. Particularly here in my comfortable suburb of Georgia, which is a pretty red state, and I'm not all that. Anyway, not to get too political. Yeah. But
no, that's my personal hobby horse. You said a minute ago about gaps in knowledge and gaps in language. And one thing that I kept thinking all the way through is that this book demands a lot of the reader in kind of accepting how strange and often incomprehensible your world is, because it's not like some normal fantasy world building where you just have to learn the lingo and look at the map and learn the magic system. In Mount Char, you keep us guessing as to the nature of things up until the very final pages. And I wonder, were you confident that readers would stick with you when it was just so weird?
You know, honestly, no. It was more that I had kind of given, I'd kind of given up on ever getting published. I mean, I'd been working on, you know, like I said, I'd written three complete novels and a half novel before this, and they all took, you know, years to do and polish, and then ultimately failed. And by the time I got around to doing Mount Char, I was like, well, you know what? I'm just going to amuse myself, and if anybody comes along for the ride, great. And if not, I will have had a good time. So it wasn't so much that I had faith that I would, you know, reach the reader. I had just kind of given up. I wanted to make it as interesting as possible, but you know, if it didn't work out, well, it didn't work out.
But see, I'm always fascinated by that, because it obviously has worked out. And it made me think, because you've mentioned Stephen King, and an episode does not go by on this show without me mentioning Stephen King. But one of the things my wife always says, because I talked about King a lot, the man means an awful lot to me. And when I'm reading his books, I always talk about them and stuff. And I remember once trying to explain to her the setup of the Dark Tower and how crazy those books are.
Yeah.
And she said to me, like, how is he so popular? How, you know, if this idea is that people who read books want a plot, they want something that isn't challenging. Like, how is he the most popular author in the world? And I always think it's quite reassuring that something like The Dark Tower, or something like even The Stand, which gets wiggy in places, and something like the fact that something like Mount Char has found an audience, it reassures me that the world of readers isn't made up of this lowest common denominator stuff, where you know the latest book from James Patterson's stable. You know, I always feel quite reassured when I read a challenging book like this, that readers are still up for a challenge.
I completely agree. There's not, you know, again, nothing against James Patterson, who's the other one? Dan Brown's kind of my hobby horse of cookie cutter fiction, I guess. And there's a place for that. There's nothing wrong with it. I mean, I've, you know, God help me, I've watched reality TV. I mean, I'm not proud of it, but I did. And I enjoyed it. And I don't think you get, I think people are entitled to enjoy anything they want to enjoy. And
of course,
No one's
going to get accused of snobber on this show, don't worry,
yeah.
Scott.
Like, yeah, okay. But I mean, I'm not, like, you know, seeing these debates on, you know, about books and on, you know, on the internet and everything. And a lot of people, it's just mean, a lot of it. I mean, my thinking is, if somebody else enjoys something, let them enjoy it. And if, you know, Mount Char, I'm really glad it found an audience. I'm thrilled. But if it hadn't, that, you know, and there's people out there who really just didn't like it either. They don't tend to write emails as much, but I see them in the book reviews. So there's people out there who just hated the book too. And that's fine too. Honestly, when you do any creative effort, you're kind of putting yourself out there, and some people are going to like it and some people aren't. So, but yeah, I am glad I found an audience.
Yeah.
And it was a little bit of a risk. I think they were all kind of scratching their heads when it was, you know, coming closer to publication. They liked it, but they're like, how are we going to market this? You know?
Well, it's one of those books, isn't it, that stands out in the landscape. And the thing I kept returning to is Gormenghast, Mervyn Peake's Gormenghast.
Yeah.
Which, when it came out, there was just nothing like it being written. In that era, there was nothing like it. And it was just like thrown to the readers with little context, and you have to just take that book you have to get that book in a headlock and make it submit to you, because it's so otherworldly and difficult. And reading Mount Char felt a bit like that, like this thing that was just nothing else like it in the landscape at that time.
Yeah, that may be true. I mean, it was just, I don't know. I wasn't striving to be weird for the sake of weirdness. It's just kind of how my head works. But the publishing industry will take some chances if they like it well enough. Mm-hmm. I got around the time I got Mount Char was, you know, coming together. I still can't believe that they actually published this. It was a book length poem about werewolves, and it was actually pretty good. But I'm just like, you know, I had to be like the one person in the world that's going to say, oh, a book length poem about werewolves. That sounds interesting. And I can't remember the author's name. I would love to plug it here, because it really was, in fact, quite good. But anyway.
This episode is supported by Novelic, the book app for people who want their suggestions from fellow readers, not an algorithm. Novelic is the perfect way to curate your TBR list, with real recommendations from fellow-minded readers broken down into genre, including, yeah, horror and all adjacent delights. You can download Novelic for free on iOS or Android devices and start browsing right away, or join a book club for more in-depth chat on your favourite topic. The Talking Scared book club is up and running for Patreon members. Try Novelic for a nicer way to find your next read. I've already mentioned the word challenging, and one of the things... Actually, I'm going to stop there and just explain what I mean. When I say challenging, I don't mean difficult. They're different things. It's not a difficult book to read at all. The pages fly by. It's full of incident and fun, but it's challenging that it makes you reconsider things, I suppose, reconsider what fiction does. And the thing that I found fascinating was the nature of ethics in this universe, because you've got these demigod characters, the librarians, and because of their elevated status, they don't feel the human consequences of their actions anymore. That's a major theme of the latter half of the book. And it leaves us totally unsure whether they're heroes or villains. Carolyn in particular, until the very end, I thought, is she even a hero or a villain? And likewise, the human protagonists are equally grey, but on a human level. So Erwin, this war hero, I thought he was going to be a villain, you know, but then he becomes much more of a heroic force. And Steve, our protagonist, he has his own demons. That's a lot of me talking, sorry, but what I'm basically asking is, were you aware that you were writing a very murky book when it comes to who we think we should be rooting for?
I really was, and that was very much on purpose. I tend to have limited patience for clear-cut good or clear-cut bad characters. It just bores me, honestly. I think one of the genres I enjoy the most is like these film noir movie genres anyway, where, you know, everybody's, even if they're like blatantly bad, but they're doing something interesting. To me, that's more engaging than someone who's just, you know, good for the sake of goodness or whatever. I've had my fill of that. I think Thomas Harris, who wrote Silence of the Lambs, he had a villain in Red Dragon that I think was even the book you wrote right before Silence of the Lambs was called Red Dragon, and the villain in that was a guy named Thomas Dolarhyde, and he was just a monster. But they also had, Harris also threw in this chapter of Dolarhyde's childhood that was just heartbreaking. I mean, and you're like, you know, if that happened to me, I probably wouldn't be the greatest guy in the world either. You know, so to answer your question, the kind of moral ambiguity and murkiness was very much on purpose.
But to me, it's more than ambiguity, because we've all read kind of anti-heroes before. With this, because of the nature of these children and their experiences, it's almost like they live on a different ethical plane altogether, almost like they can't be judged, because and their reactions to things, like there is a scene of sexual assault in the book, and the victim of that sexual assault is very cool and almost callous towards herself and very matter of fact. And then there is one moment where she kind of shows some vulnerability, but it feels like we're dealing with characters who have an entirely different emotional register than we're used to in fiction. Almost like the Greek gods, you know, almost like the pantheon of gods, where we can't apply human ethics to them.
Well, some of that's kind of on that, a little more calculated than it might appear as well. My impression is that people who've been through really extreme trauma, like pretty much everybody in this book, tend to be, you know, they've got that, like, that 1,000-yard stare. You talk, you know, like the soldiers coming back from, you know, these god-awful trench warfare, 2 years in the jungle or whatever. And they're, you know, they may not be openly reactive to stimuli, but it's definitely percolating down in there. So, you know, they've kind of shut down, and you know, they're looking at the world through a porthole, but there's still something going on in there, and that may not have conveyed as well as I'd hoped, but they are, I feel like they're just, it's not so much that they're different. Well, I mean, I guess they are, you're right, there is a different moral plane that they're playing on. It's like death doesn't matter and that kind of thing, but they're also struggling with emotions that they, you know, there's just no way out. That's the only thing they can do is shut down.
Okay. And
they've all got their, you know, kind of, everybody's got their habits. Like, you know, Carolyn becomes this ice queen. Jennifer stays stoned all the time. Margaret just absolutely lost her mind. David's, you know, malicious. Mike.
Well, yeah. And the way I start to think of it is not so much of a spectrum of hero to villain, and more as a kind of hierarchy of victims.
Yeah.
Because we find out that father has been torturing these children for a reason, which we actually don't need to go into. But it's for a reason. And even the worst among them, David, is transformed into what he is. And like you said with Dolarhyde, you know, you have a degree of empathy, if not sympathy. But the top, or perhaps the bottom of that hierarchy, depending on how you want to look at it, is Margaret, who is this girl who is forced to live and then die and wake and rot. And it's horrible. And even at the end, when we discover why father has been doing this, that it's at least for some good purpose, it's still hard to forgive him for Margaret.
It really is. Yeah. I had that exact, it's interesting you should say that. That was kind of hit me after I was kind of done writing the book. I'm like, okay, well, you know, maybe you can make the case where, you know, that father had his reasons, and, you know, you can't make an omelet without breaking a few eggs. But honestly, if you could go back and explain the whole thing to little baby Margaret before all this happened to her, why what's about to happen to her is necessary. And if you can make that case morally, then okay, you win. But I'm not sure that case can be made. I mean, I think that's just, you can't make a justification for what happens to Margaret. At least I can't think of one. And that's tough. So, yeah, I mean, there's definitely some bad in there, too. There's some good and some bad.
Well, there is some good, and I'm going to caveat now so I don't put people off, because there are parts of this book that make me laugh out loud. There are parts that have something like the tone of a Terry Pratchett book, or the more whimsical Neil Gaiman book. So it's very much a journey of light and shade. So, you know, don't be frightened. But this is a horror podcast, so I'm going to focus on the dark shit, you know. And it's an incredibly cruel book in parts, incredibly, astonishingly so. And despite not being, I suppose, obviously in marketing terms, a horror novel. It does contain more scenes of kind of outright brutality than some splatterpunk titles I could mention. And I've seen one interview with you in which you said that you cut a scene set in Margaret's bedroom because you thought it would be too bloody for some reasons. So two questions. Okay. What were you sparing us from? And considering what you do leave on the page, how on earth were you worried about that?
Well, I mean, it didn't really. Okay, so to answer the first question, what was in there is, you know, Margaret had this kind of severed head fetish that, you know, David would always bring her these severed heads. So what was in her room was that she had a bed made out of severed heads and they would kiss her to sleep. That was the scene that I took out of Margaret's bed. That was the scene that I cut. I just couldn't. That, you know, they were her friends and they're, oh, good night, we love you, you're so beautiful, and, you know, all these, she's lying on this, you know, kind of fluffy pillow or this fluffy bed of severed heads, and I thought it was a very Margaret thing to do, but I could also, it might have been just a little bit over the top for, you know, kind of general audiences. I'm sorry, what was the back half of the question?
You know, well,
why did I cut
considering it? What you did show us, why were you worried about that scene? Because you roast children alive in a bull, Scott.
Yeah.
You roast children alive. Like, what were you worried about?
the roasting alive had a purpose in the plot. Like, honestly, originally, that scene, you know, don't share your cattle, because father was teaching them not to share their catalogs. And the scene as originally written was just father gave them a stern lecture and he yelled at them. And I'm like, you know, it was one of those things where I was going back through it. I'm like, you know, no, this is bland. This is, you know, that it's, everybody's been yelled at by their dad. You need something with a little more punch. And so what could we, you know, so then I'm like, well, what's the worst thing I can think of? And, well, you know, hey, so that the bull scene at least had a kind of a keystone of the plot. You know, I mean, these guys aren't going to share their catalog, and it made a big impact on every one of them, and it just kind of showed what father was capable of. So it worked in a lot of ways. The thing with Margaret, although I thought it was kind of, I don't know, black humor, I guess would be the way I would put it. It was going to gross a lot of people out, and it didn't really tell you anything you needed to know about the story, I guess is why.
So that seemed gratuitous where the other stuff didn't. Is that?
Yeah, I'd say, yeah. I mean, if you have a really dark sense of humor, there are people out there who would have found it funny. I thought it was, you know, like I said, I've got a pitch black sense of humor, and I was kind of chuckling through it, and it was supposed to be a little bit funny, and it gave you a little bit more insight into Margaret, but in the end, I could just see, you know, half of America like, okay, this is enough. I'm throwing it across the room kind of thing.
Okay. I mean, I'm someone who as often admits the fact that I think American Psycho is the funniest book I've ever read. So I'd have been okay with it.
Some people would, not everybody. I'm not sure everybody would, but no. Anyway, it is.
I'm very proud of my British, of my fellow countrymen, because we have a mordant sense of humor.
Oh my God. The whole nation is hilarious. It's just, everything is that much funnier coming from the UK.
Yeah.
So good on you guys.
It's all right. It's a sense of humor born from centuries of oppression. That's what it is. Yeah. Sticking with cruelty, because why wouldn't we? the greatest cruelty of all in this book, and I'm going to say it's almost cruelty against the reader because it haunted me, is this nightmarish concept of pain and suffering without end.
And yeah.
It crops up a few times. Like, so the librarians are brought back time and time again, despite how they die. It's almost a bit Groundhog Day that they start to die in increasingly elaborate ways. But to paraphrase, however badly they might need to die for good, they could not. And then late in the book, there is the antagonist, David, gets a comeuppance, which is just beyond. I just that idea of someone in eternal torment just horrifies me, and that to me is the essence of true horror in this novel, that potential for endless suffering.
Yeah, that one freaked me out too. That was it was probably easier to write it than it would be for me to have read it. I don't really remember where that came from, to be honest with you. It might have been, there were some experiments once upon a time with actual, like, physical experiments where they would, like, implant a probe in the pleasure center of your brain as like a surgical anesthetic. My brother, he was a psych major, and he told me about it. And, you know, people were like, you know, it was apparently so good that they were like, I'm so happy I got cancer because it meant that I get to experience this, you know, you could just press a button and it you know, it lights up the pleasure center of your brain. Mm-hmm. And it occurred to me, yeah, you could do the same thing with the pain. Presumably there's a pain center and they're floating around in there somewhere. And that would be like the worst thing ever. Just every pain you could ever feel all at once forever. I was like, yeah, that sounds like something, a God level punishment. Because the other stuff I was coming up with wasn't really, I think Carolyn actually talks about it a little bit in the book, where she's going to like try to impale Steve on it or David on his spear or, you know, stuff like that. But none of it really seemed to have the kind of scope that, you know, this biblical vengeance that she wanted to bring down on him for good reasons.
Yeah, because there's a bit in the book where she talks about humanity have the sort of recourse and the reassurance of suicide, which is an incredibly dark thing to say, you know, and obviously we don't treat that subject lightly, but for the purpose of this book, you can understand how that works, can't you? That, you know, like there is at least an off ramp to the worst suffering. Whereas to take that away, it reminds me of something I once saw that I actually struggle to talk about because it disturbs me so much. Is, have you seen the series Black Mirror?
Oh yeah, I bet I know which one you're talking about too.
No, it's actually not going to be. I think, are you thinking of the Black Museum one where the guy is strapped into the electric chair and just electrocuted over and over again?
I was thinking about the Christmas one.
Yes.
White Christmas.
That's the one we're on. Yeah. The one where someone is basically left in a time loop that...
Yeah.
It's a weekend for the people at the macro level, but for the person in the loop, it is next best thing to eternity.
And, I was like, ugh. Yeah.
And for months after watching that, I had to sort of manually block out the thought whenever I thought about it. It disturbed me so much.
And
it made me think of that.
Did it? Okay, yeah. I think I'm pretty sure I saw that after I wrote this, but I can definitely see the connection. It was just horrifying.
Yeah, completely. And you know what? The sad part, the part that really made me, again, it's the same theme, the idea of, you know, just torment, is with the lions. So there are two lions that come into this book. I'm going to be honest, Scott, they were the things I cared about the most. These two lions, Dresden and Nagasaki.
Most people will agree with you on that.
And they're the reason I don't really like Carolyn, even at the end, because she treats them as disposable. But when we first meet them, they're kind of kept in this dickhead sort of rapper's enclosure. And the father, Dresden, says there was no escape. The rest of his life stretched out before him, worse than any nightmare. And I was just so upset by that. More than David in eternal cosmic torment. The idea of this lion being unhappy with the rest of his life.
I'm with you. I think that's really common, and it's weird how it works. That, like, I mean, I think some people, maybe not everybody, but some people can have like unrestrained empathy for animals, including myself, can have unrestrained empathy for animals in a way that you don't really see as commonly with people. And I think it's just because, you know, we're growing up watching, you know, 5 murders a day on television or whatever it is. And you kind of have to shut that part of your brain off, just to function, you know, in today's the world. You can't empathize to the same degree all the time. Otherwise you just never, you know, you couldn't function. But with animals, it's different. They're ethically blameless and at least I feel sort of protective towards them. So yeah.
I'm the kind of person who cheers every time I hear somebody's been mauled at a zoo by a tiger.
Yeah.
I'm very much on the side of the beasts. And I, to be honest, I mean, I years ago made a pact that I would never, ever go to a zoo ever again because of exactly what the emotion I felt reading about your lions. It's just, I can't stand the idea of one of the most horrific things I ever saw. We're getting on a tangent now, is I went to Busch Gardens in Florida.
Oh, yeah.
There was a enclosure where they had a tiger and the roller coaster went above it, and I just thought, that is the most abhorrent thing I've ever seen. I always thought I would never go to zoos again. So when I met your lions, wow, that's all I cared about.
Yeah, I liked them too. They were a lot of fun. I had a good time with those. For what it's worth, I'm with you. There was a movie, I think it was a Brazilian horror movie. It was about, this is the only movie I have not been able to sit through. The only horror movie in like 20 years that I had to turn it off. It was bothering me so much. It was something about like abandoned Brazilian dogs like rose up and took over the city or something like that, but it was shot with
Oh, is it called White God?
That's it. That's the one. Couldn't do it. Yeah. I made it up 20 minutes in. I'm like, somebody dropped a puppy off at an intersection. I was like, I can't watch this.
Yeah, I haven't seen it. I haven't seen it, but I, well, you know what? That has actually brought me to the bone I want to pick with you. And you're going to know what this is in a second. So first of all, to set the scene for this, your author bio says that you live with a large pack of foster dogs. And
I do.
One of my listeners has asked me to ask you how many you have.
Well, at the time the book was written, we had 7. They have many of, like 4 of them have since gone on to their greater reward. So we're in the house. I've got 3 right now. Actually, I think in the room I've got 3 right now.
Okay. And how long have you been fostering dogs? My mother does this. I think it's a wonderful thing to do.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Over 10 years. I mean, I've had dogs, you know, one way or another since 93, I think. I couldn't have one growing up because my brother was allergic, but I always wanted one. And like, as soon as I got my own place for the first time, I got my first dog, and it's, you know, it's gone up and down over the years. And sometimes we foster, and, you know, sometimes I had a couple where somebody in the neighborhood just moved away and left their dog, and she was like starving in the backyard. And so we took her in, and, you know, so typically 3 is a low number, but I think the most I've ever had in the house at once was 16.
Wow. Wow.
Puppies. It was puppies. They went quick, but it was a houseful.
That would have been amazing. I haven't mentioned him for a few weeks, but I've got a dog called Ted who I've done that thing where I've said I'm not having children, so I've got to infantilize the puppy.
And we should start a club. Yeah.
Yeah. I talk about him all the time, and I'm trying to basically crowbar him into being the show mascot. And I don't know if the listeners are going with it or not, but as far as I'm concerned, he's the show mascot. But all of this brings me to my bone to pick, which is, and you've been asked it before, no doubt, but you're clearly a dog lover. So how could you bring yourself to write a scene in which our hero shoots dozens of them in the face?
So, okay. The book that I wrote, right, the one that I was talking about where the wolf, you know, kind of comes down from the north and goes to look for the forest god, was written pretty much strictly from the vantage point of wolves and dogs and et cetera, you know, canines, basically. And that was the book I wrote right before Mount Char. And I could kind of feel myself wanting to slip back into that mode where the dogs were always the good guys. So I made it a conscious decision that this time the dogs were going to be the bad guys. And I will go ahead and tell you that it's even more horrible than you're probably imagining, because the dogs, as physically described in Mount Char, were my dogs. I was having trouble keeping track of who was mauling what. So I was like picturing little Scooter on my ankle and Thane over there, you know, the fiendish master. I did have a dog named Thane up until about 6 months ago. And he was actually kind of a goofball instead of a mastermind. But so anyway, that was just how I was keeping track of him in my head was, you know, okay, and I've got mama dog hanging on my right arm and, you know, et cetera. So they were all, but you know, no dogs were harmed in the production of this book, and they all got snacks when it was published. So
it's just so weird to read a book in which dogs are the villains, because these days I think we've all become so obsessed by dogs. If we've kind of replaced cats as the social media creature of choice, and they're so kind of ubiquitous and universally the good guys. It was really quite jarring to read them as kind of antagonistic forces.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I absolutely agree. And some of that was, you know, some of that was on purpose. It was just something a little different. I didn't want to fall into the trap of writing the same book over and over again. So I said, well, let's have the dogs be the bad guys this time. Well, who can be the good guys? Ooh, lion. You know, everybody likes lions. Let's try that.
Of course, the lions aren't the only big cat in the story. You've got a sort of godlike tiger.
Right.
I'm not going to try and remember his name off the top of my head.
Nobunaga.
Nobunaga, right. Okay, Nobunaga. So in the periphery of this story, kind of almost like in old maps with the kind of here be monsters, if you think of that as a metaphor for this narrative, you have these references to these otherworldly forces that are kind of rivals to Father and the library. One of them is called Barry O'Shea.
Yeah, right.
there is one called the Duke and one simply called Q33 North.
Right.
We never find out what they are.
Nope. That was kind of on purpose. I like the idea, you know, I mean, a lot of writing is, you know, again, getting back to Stephen King, he talks about letting the reader's imagination do some of the work for you. Like if you hear, you know, scratching on the door in the middle of the night, this isn't Dance Macabre. He's talking about if you're scratching on the door in the middle of the night, and you know, it's something bad out there, but until you open the door, it could be anything. If you open
it's
up the
old
door,
monkey's paw paradox, right? It's
right. So your imagination is working, you know, all we really know about the Duke is that he's the Duke. I mean, you can, whatever is right for that person is probably what they're going to conjure up in their head. So I like to leave, you know, sometimes you gotta get down to like actually spell out what's going on, but I think it's also okay to leave a few little kind of, you know, choose your own adventure type hooks in the story that let the reader's imagination do, you know, what they will, fill in the blanks for them.
My question then is, do you know what Barry O'Shea is?
I do. I'll tell you if you want. I mean, it's, I don't want to, again.
Well, don't spoil them all, but I want to know what Barry O'Shea is, because I'm loving the idea of this, like, Nyarlathotep figure that's like an Irish name. It's just making me laugh.
No, he's, he was, like, a 17th century alchemist who, his beloved died and he couldn't live with it, so he trafficked with dark forces trying to get her back, and it didn't work out as well as he'd hoped, and now he's got all these tentacles. And I think some of these were actually written. I cut out a lot of stuff that really wasn't serving the story. I think Barry O'Shea, I don't think Barry O'Shea was one of them, but there was a lot more about Nobunaga, and Q-33 North, I think, had at least a little bit of a backstory. He figured in spots. Some of it was just, you didn't want to bog the story down, or at least I didn't want to bog the story down with a lot of minutiae that didn't really move the plot forward. You know, nobody got time for that.
Well, that's always the balance of that, isn't it? Because I'm one of these people, I love mythology, I love lore, I want to know more and more and more and more, you know? I like appendices to things, I'm one of those nerds. I'm the guy who, when people say, like, you ruin the monster in Alien, like, with people say that Prometheus ruined the Alien franchise by over-explaining things, I like the explanation.
Do you?
But I realize I'm in the minority. I'm the kind of guy who reads about, you know, the expanded universe stuff on Wikipedia, because I just love the lore. But I get why in a novel this stuffed with incident and concept, you didn't want to kind of litter it anymore.
I think where this one came from was there was a book called The Moten God's Eye, which was written by it was big in the 70s. It was by Larry Niven and Jerry Pournelle, science fiction. And it was, I was reading it. I really liked the book. I'm not sure how well it holds up these days, but at the time it was one of my favorites. And he, either Niven or Pournelle, was talking about how it originally opened with this big space battle. And the way the novel was actually published, it opened in the aftermath of the battle. And the only thing that ever happened, the only thing you really learn about it is from the people talking about it after the fact. And I thought it was kind of a cool effect that they had all this, you know, and Star Wars is to a certain extent the same way. I mean, the original episode four, you know, kind of opens and you're in the middle of this big war that nobody knows anything about, and you kind of got to pick up the clues along the way. And I thought that was fun. So that was kind of the approach I was going for with that.
Yeah. It's that kind of worm's eye view, right? You know, you can only see the little bit that's available to you. Yeah. Yeah. I get that. Well, I mean, considering you've got all this information that you've withheld from us and all these notes and this, you know, marginalia, would you ever consider returning to this world? Because I would like to know how Caroline is doing as a god emperor, because I'm still not convinced she should be left in charge.
Yeah, I'm with you. So I would absolutely consider it. And I've even like kicked a couple of ideas around. The thing is, I just don't. So I think sometimes less is more, right? So for instance, I'll just go ahead. The Matrix, right? I mean, I really liked the first Matrix movie. The second, third, and fourth one, I don't know, man. I'm not sure they've really added anything to the overall mix. But at the same time, you've also got stuff like Mad Max, which I loved the first two, not so. And when the third one came out, I was like 16 or something. I was like, I was ready for this to blow me away. It was really just pretty mediocre. But then 20 years later, we got, you know, Fury Road, which did blow me away. So I can see arguments either way for like a returning to, you know, kind of a Mount Char universe. But the answer I'll give you is if I come up with something that I'm pretty sure will work, I will do it. But I'm not going to do it just like for, because I'm pretty sure it will sell, if you follow the distinction.
Yeah, yeah. And that's why you're different to James Patterson.
that about 10 figures in my bank account.
Yeah, well, with that in mind, then, what is next for you? I read you were working on a book called The Lost House of Bramblewood Lane.
Yes, that's... the last year or so, I have a day job. I'm a computer guy. And the last year or so, it was just absolutely grueling. I was no joke working 7 days a week at the day job. And I mean, 12-hour days, 16-hour days, just all the time. We had this big project going on. That is no longer true. And I am kind of turning my attentions back to a partially completed manuscript that, God willing, I'll have out at some point. I've given up on promising when.
And is that title, The Bramblewood Lane?
It is the same story, probably come out under a different title.
Is there anything you could tell us about it? I don't want to pry if not.
Okay, let me think. It's similar to Mount Char in that you open with a point of view character who doesn't really have any idea what's going on, exploring a very weird world, visibly different from our own, but descended from it for reasons. How's that?
That's frankly told me nothing, but with the pretense that it has.
Our boy is looking for his ex-girlfriend who may or may not have destroyed the world.
That's more like it. That's more like it. That's the elevator pitch we all wanted to hear. Okay, well, can you recommend for us a book by another author that you think we should read and tell us why?
Oh gosh, well, I already mentioned the one I had in mind was Red Dragon by Thomas Harris, which I thought was absolutely fantastic. But we've already talked about that, so that's probably not a good one to end on. I did read recently We Are All Completely Fine, which was like a kind of a support group for survivors of serial killers. It's kind of a short novel by
Daryl Gregory novel, right?
Yeah. I thought that was really fun.
It's on my Kindle. I've had for about 3 years. I've still not read it.
Oh, really? No, it's good. It's a lot of fun. It's a quick read too. I read it just recently and I really enjoyed that one. And if you're in the mood for something really harrowing, but nonfiction, try The Unforgiving Stars Above, which is about the Donner Party who hiked into, the frigid winter mountains, and not all of them made it out. So it's a true story. Or, you know, man, I can't remember. I can't remember the last time something I was just like, this is awful.
You are speaking language, man. I had Alma Katsu on the show recently. We talked about her book, The Hunger, which is about, have you read that?
No, it's on my Kindle.
Yeah, obviously, we then started talking about the Unforgiving Stars Above, and I always say to people, it's the closest thing you can get to a non-fiction horror novel.
Yeah, it was just, I mean, you don't often get to use the words like harrowing, unironically. It was just, I'm like, my God, this is horrible. It was just, yeah, I mean, if you and me are both like, this is jaw-dropping, then, you know, readers take note.
Indeed, yeah, tread carefully, yeah. Don't eat before it, yeah. Or probably do, I mean, either way.
Yeah, right.
Last question, Scott. What truly scares you?
Oh, gosh. With physical pain of the type that was mentioned in Mount Char in several cases, I had a kidney stone once probably 15 years ago, and it was just absolutely jaw-dropping. I mean, at the time, I didn't have any health insurance, so I was I got to the point where I was willing to accept bankruptcy to make the pain go away. It was just absolutely mind-boggling how bad it was. And you can just get there and it just stays painful and just never goes away. And that remains pretty darn scary to me.
How old are you, don't mind me asking?
Oh, gosh. I was probably early 30s, 29, 31, something like that.
Right. Because I'm 38 now. And I'm approaching that time in life where I'm expecting things like to start going wrong for me.
Yeah.
I've reached that time in life where dots are taking far less interest in my testicles and much more in my prostate. Yeah. You know?
Yeah, right.
And it's just that's like,
it's
okay.
Tragic, yeah.
Yeah, now things are going to start going wrong. And the kidney stone is one that I'm just thinking, oh, please, no.
Yeah, I went around asking women who had both given birth and had a kidney stone, you know, which one was worse? And she's like, oh yeah, it's the kidney stone. It's much worse. So,
yeah. Well, I'm going to let you say that because I'm not saying that because that's more than my life is worth.
Yeah.
Yeah. Scott said that, not me.
Well, I'm just quoting. I took a survey.
Right. Let's quit while we're just about ahead.
Yeah.
Normally, I tell people to flock out and buy the book if I like it. If I don't say that, generally means that I have quiet thoughts. In your case, I don't need to say that. People have bought this book. But UK listeners, it's out now from Titan. We haven't told you anything that will spoil it for you. And quite frankly, it's one of the most startling, unexpected and unique stories I've read in many a year. So I recommend it. And American listeners, if you've not read it yet, then quite frankly, up your game. But Scott Hawkins, thank you so much for writing the book. Thanks for coming on the show, and thank you for talking Scared.
It's been my pleasure. I really enjoyed talking with you. Thanks, Neil.
I've got to give you guys some credit for this week's episode. Lots of you have mentioned Mount Char to me over the last 2 years, and it proved to be every bit as amazing as you said. Easily one of the best books I've read in the last decade. Easy. I doubt I'd have gotten around to it, to be honest. So yeah, thanks for the recommendation. Scott's book is so just ridiculously imaginative. At first, I was a bit worried it was going to be whimsy and absurdity for the sake of it. Like we talked about, Scott does take chances with the audience's tolerance for absolutely inexplicable events for quite a few chapters. But as the truth of this world slowly starts to reveal itself, this emotional element creeps in on the sly until all of a sudden you're totally wrapped up in this story. It's like Stephen King, Neil Gaiman, Terry Pratchett and Kelly Link got together to write the maddest, cruelest story that they could think up. And there's nothing much else to say except it's wonderful. I can't wait for whatever he publishes next. And who else heard him talk about his animal book for adults and thought, yeah, I want that right now? Who says grown-ups don't want books about animals, and why are they so wrong? The animals are the best part of this book. That's why I devoted about 20 minutes to asking about the dogs in Mount Char. I can't actually believe he named them after his own rescue animals. That's a level of evil and masochism that I just didn't pick up from Scott's of Unkiller Manor. Anyway, look, I digress, and I've got to be quick with the outro this week because I'm trying to produce 3 episodes in 1 week for scheduling reasons. I've got a lot of good stuff coming up, but not much time to turn it around. The 3 episodes I'm talking about actually form a sort of thematic trilogy. Mount Char is all about children with incredible powers, and that's a conceit that runs through the next episodes as well. Next week we've got J.M. Miro and his dark fantasy epic of magical Victorian orphans, ordinary monsters. Following that, it's Stephen Lloyd and a whole host of satanic shenanigans at a prestigious boarding school in Friend of the Devil. One of those books I adored. The other, not so much, and you got to tune in to find out. If you want to get in touch, you can do so via the usual channels. It's email to talkingscaredpod@gmail.com or find me on Twitter and Instagram at talkscaredpod. Please subscribe, please leave a review, and if you want to support the show, I'll repeat that you can do so via Patreon. A few dollars a month and you get hours of bonus content, and it's less edited, so I talk a lot more shit. One more thing, just to say, I did a bit of research and found that the book-length werewolf poem that Scott mentioned is called Sharp Teeth by Toby Barlow, and it sounds a lot of fun, you know, if you're into werewolf poetry. And why would you not be? Other than that, we're all tidied away this week. I'm hopefully off on holiday, but Manchester Airport is in such apocalyptic disarray, it's hit the news, that I may up spending the next 9 days in the departure lounge drinking awful coffee and slowly rocking back and forth in the corner. Either way, you'll still have an episode next week, because like all good podcast hosts, I plan ahead. So, speak soon, and until then, be kind to animals, read outside your catalogue, and don't let the power go to your head. Read good books, and remember, it's good to be scared.